Hi there, and welcome to Brain Observations, the podcast where we are curious about how the brain and mind works and how you can use this knowledge to improve your experience of life. I set out to find and talk to some of the most knowledgeable people out there, and at the end of each episode, I sum up what we have learned from today's guest. Me, I'm Maria Sundell. I'm a clinical neurologist, and with this podcast, I hope to make scientific evidence on well-being and brain health more easily available, and my wish is to inspire you to learn more and find ways to improve your own life. I also want to mention that even though I am a medical doctor, this is a personal project and not affiliated with my hospital. The information in this podcast is meant to educate and inspire and should not be taken as medical advice. I advise you to discuss any potential changes to your lifestyle with your own personal doctor. This is even more important if you are experiencing trouble with your mental health. Today's guest, Julianne Holt Lundstad, is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University in Utah, United States. Her research is focused on the long-term health effects of social connection. She's the recipient of numerous awards for her outstanding work and is regularly featured in different media outlets. She recently did a TEDx talk on the vital importance of social relationships and is regularly asked to provide her expert opinion and act as a scientific advisor for different boards, initiatives, and governmental agencies. In this episode, we learn that commonly discussed lifestyle habits, such as diet and exercise, although very important for us, are not the only major factors determining our long-term health. The amount and quality of our social connections has been found to be deeply important, and here, Professor Holt Lundstad will tell us all we need to know to reflect on and possibly impact the social connections in our own life. Welcome to Brain Observations. It's really nice to have you here. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about how important other humans are for ourselves as humans. That is social connections, which is something that you have a very extensive experience in. So if we start by talking about social connection, how would that be defined?
Yeah, that's tough because when it comes to any aspect of our social relationships, there's many definitions out there. And similarly, in the research, there have been many different ways of measuring the impact, measuring, you know, all the different aspects of our relationships. And so my colleagues and I, we use the term social connection to really refer to an umbrella term that encompasses the variety of ways in which it's been conceptualized and measured in research that includes three broad components. The first is the structure of our social connections. You know, this can include how we connect to others in terms of, you know, the size of our social network, the frequency of our social contact. It's often the kind of more objective, numerical kinds of things in terms of how we measure that. So it looks at the existence of relationships and roles and contact in our life. The second component is the functions that our relationships serve. So how we connect to others in a way that may result in either the objective or perceived availability of resources. So social support, can we rely on others to meet many of our needs? And then the third major component is the quality of our relationships. So our relationships can be incredibly satisfying and bring lots of joy, but our relationships can also bring conflict and strain and ambivalence. And so the quality really gets at the extent to which there are positive and negative aspects in our relationships. And so this term social connection is used as an umbrella term to encompass all three of these components, and such that high levels of social connection would be associated with protection and low levels of social connection would be more associated with risk.
And historically in healthcare and research, we have focused a lot on the structure of social connections, right? The amount and the type of relationships that we do have.
Yeah. So a lot of the very early research looked at social integration and social isolation. So, you know, integration on the one hand of having these relationships in our lives and isolation, you know, lacking those, that epidemiological studies were linked to very important outcomes, including mortality. Over time, the research has expanded to include these other components, but what the evidence suggests is that all of them are important for our health and well-being.
And has our social relationships changed historically over time? Is it something that is evolving over time?
It's a great question, and unfortunately, I don't feel like I have a great answer. I think a lot of people have wanted to know that very answer, and particularly in light of recent trends and the recent pandemic. But even the time preceding the pandemic, leading up to that, there's been a lot of talk about, are we less socially connected? Is there a loneliness epidemic? And the unfortunate part is that we, not only within nations, but even across nations, haven't been able to adequately measure this consistently over time. So yes, there are many, many studies that have measured this over time, but they haven't necessarily measured it consistently. So if you're comparing a measurement that was done 2 decades ago to a different measurement that's been done more recently, it's hard to say whether that reflects true change when a different measurement tool was used. And so that becomes really tricky. There is some evidence to suggest that it's been very stable over time. But certainly there's been some recent evidence just within the last few years to suggest that prevalence rate, at least for loneliness, have increased, for instance, from pre-pandemic to during the pandemic. So it's like, I hate to, you know, say definitively yes or definitively no, but, you know, we have some evidence to suggest it's been relatively stable, but also some evidence to suggest that it may be increasing. I think the critical point is that there is evidence that a significant portion of the population is affected. And so whether it's increased or not, there is this portion of the population that is at risk and that we need to take very seriously.
You and your team have done extensive research over a long period of time on this area of social connectedness. And what have you seen? What are the links between social connections and health?
Yeah. So the kinds of work I've done in particular that can address this question is, I've done a couple of meta-analyses looking specifically at mortality. And then more recently, I served here in the U.S. on a National Academy of Expert Consensus Committee where we reviewed all of the available evidence. And so, and looking at this evidence, what we find is that some of the strongest evidence is associated with risk for premature mortality. And so, for instance, if we look to my meta-analyses, which include data, these are prospective studies, so looking over time and all of the available data worldwide at the time of the publication. And so the first of these showed that those who are more socially connected have a 50% increased odds of survival compared to those who are less socially connected. And the second one looks specifically at social deficits, so isolation, loneliness, and living alone, and found that each of those were independent and significant predictors of risk for premature mortality. And so, in addition, large-scale epidemiological studies have been published. And generally, overall, there's very robust evidence when it comes to mortality. I should point out that this is disease-related mortality, because I think a lot of people assume, oh, it's driven entirely by suicide. And certainly it can affect suicide, but this is either all-cause mortality or disease-related mortality. But there's also evidence to suggest that social connections significantly influence non-fatal outcomes as well, so morbidity, with the strongest evidence around cardiovascular disease and stroke. There is some evidence among other health conditions such as cancer, diabetes, but there's just not as much evidence. Not to say it doesn't show an effect. There's just fewer studies. And so that evidence is stronger for cardiovascular outcomes. And then there's also evidence for mental health outcomes and cognitive health outcomes, including things like dementia and Alzheimer's disease. So we have growing evidence that social connections influences not only our risk for premature mortality, but significant chronic health conditions as well.
And do we know how it stands in relation to other lifestyle behaviors that we have, such as exercise, diet, and smoking, and these things?
Yeah. So in my meta-analyses, we tried to benchmark the effect sizes relative to some of these other factors. So keep in mind that this is, because this is aggregate data, and we're in essence comparing the effect sizes to other effect sizes that have been published in other research. And what that shows is that these effect sizes were comparable to relatively important factors, including things like excessive alcohol consumption, flu vaccine, obesity, physical inactivity, air pollution, smoking cessation. So what this suggests is that the extent to which our social connections influence risk is comparable to these other factors that, of course, we take very seriously for our own personal health, but also how public health takes seriously in terms of investing resources into addressing. And it suggests that we should really be taking our social connections just as seriously.
Definitely. And when you, I really love the TEDx talk that you did recently, and you had this great pie chart in it where you showed how much different parts of our health actually contribute to our overall mortality. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So this is adapted from a figure that the CDC put together, so the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, and estimated the extent to which various factors influence and contribute to population health, including genetics, lifestyle and behavioral factors, medicine and medical factors, and then social factors. And according to this figure, more than half of that is, you know, social and environmental factors. And so, of course, social connections is just part of that. And so the larger social determinants of health would be encompassed in that as well. But it does suggest that it is a big contributor to population health, and that we certainly should be taking it much more seriously.
I think this is really fascinating data, because when we think about health, what we usually think about and what we've learned through our life is that you need to think about your diet, you need to think about your exercise, you need to think about not smoking, not drinking too much alcohol, and you go to the dentist, go to the doctor. But this is such a huge part of our health and of our mortality, and it feels like it has been kind of neglected.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because even during the pandemic, I think there was so much greater awareness of the importance of connecting socially, and much greater awareness of the risk associated with social isolation. But even still, that the attention was focused on psychological well-being and how it might affect our mental health, and still very little recognition that this can affect our physical health. And so I feel like it's certainly a factor that is very underappreciated relative to the strength of the effect that has been demonstrated in the research.
What do you believe is the biological reason for this effect?
So, of course, research is still ongoing, and we're really trying to understand this better, but there is evidence of multiple biological mechanisms. So, for instance, it's been linked to cardiovascular, neuroendocrine, immune functioning, cellular aging. And so it's associated with many, many biomarkers that have been shown to be linked to chronic health conditions. And so one particular pathway I'll just use as an example is that there's some research to suggest that, in essence, when we are isolated or lonely, so in essence, lacking proximity to trusted others, that this can heighten a sense of either a sense of threat or heighten a sense of awareness, in the sense that we have to deal with everything on our own. But that this would, in essence, signal other areas of the body, in particular the hypothalamic pituitary axis, the HPA axis, that would in turn influence other kinds of responses. And that could, for example, heighten inflammation. And so inflammation has been linked to not only chronic health conditions such as heart disease and cancer and diabetes, and But it's also been linked to depression, as well as to Alzheimer's disease. So for example, if these inflammatory responses are maintained more chronically, this can over time put us at greater risk for these various outcomes and could potentially be a common pathway that would explain what might otherwise seem like diverse kinds of outcomes.
So since we are social beings, it's sort of a remnant from the history of time that if we get disconnected from the tribe, basically, we are more vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely.
And that initiates a stress response that are detrimental over time. Do we know if the feeling of being part of a larger community or feeling somehow connected to all other humans have an effect, even if we are not meeting or physically interacting with these people?
That's something that I think that a lot of people wanted to know, especially as we were having to limit social contact over the pandemic. And there is some research, for instance, that perceptions of social support have been linked to blunted stress responses. So, for instance, some of my early research, I remember doing laboratory-based studies where we would bring people in the lab, hook them up to physiological equipment, and ask them to do some kind of standardized stress protocol. And what we found was that participants' stress reactions, so the change from kind of a resting state to the stress state, these stress reactions were much stronger among people whose networks had few supportive relationships, but were actually blunted among those that had networks filled with more supportive relationships. And what this suggests is that when we know that we can, that even if that person or a group of people aren't there with us, that we have a greater sense of ability to handle whatever threat we're dealing with because we know that we can count on them if needed. And whereas maybe a much more stronger reaction if we feel like we have to handle that entirely on our own. There is some other research done by my colleague Bert Uccino, who has done some research where he had participants even just imagine different kinds of relationships. And even just conjuring up and thinking about a supportive relationship was associated with less physiological reactivity to a stressor. And so what that suggests is, at least in the moment, is that those responses are blunted. However, of course, those are just snapshots. And really, it's these sustained kinds of responses over time that influence our health. And so if sustained and chronic, we could see how that could lead to better or worse outcomes depending on what our relationships may look like.
So even just the perception of safety, of social safety, has an effect.
Yeah. And so testing the limits of that, though, particularly, you know, I'm thinking in the context of the pandemic, is how long can we be apart from them with and still maintain that sense of safety, right? You know, are we able to maintain that because we know we still have access? And if that access is cut off, maybe that's no longer sustained. And so, we do have to think about some of the complications factors as well. And there certainly is some evidence to suggest that, you know, objectively having people around is associated with lower risk. And so, you know, it might be that there needs to be at least periodic contact in order for that benefit to be sustained.
How much do we know about the quality of the connection, the quality of the relationship?
Yeah. So what we know is that, and here, I'm going to speak, you know, very broadly, and then I can certainly go into more detail, but very broadly speaking, the evidence suggests that more positive, supportive kinds of relationships are associated with health benefits and protection, whereas negativity in relationships, relationship conflict, strain, neglect, abuse, these are associated with poorer kinds of outcomes and increased risk. And that's been shown in epidemiological research that has looked at mortality to these physiological kinds of studies that I just mentioned.
It would be really interesting to know if there would be a cutoff for sort of number of relationships, but I understand that this would be difficult because even if you have, let's say, 5 friends, that doesn't say much about the connection you have with those people and how, like when you do the research, how do you look at sort of numbers to put people in different groups?
Yeah. And so it's tricky because some studies just look at it on a continuum. And so there's, you know, some evidence to just suggest more is better than having fewer, none. We don't necessarily have good evidence on what that upper limit is, because certainly people ask about that as well. But a lot of research also just kind of chunks it, you know, so having 1-3 relationships versus 3-6 versus 6-9 or 9 or more. And it's interesting because some of this research suggests that there is benefit with more, but there seems to be somewhat of a, I hate to use the term cutoff or threshold, because I don't want anyone to come away thinking like, oh, this is the number, this is all I need. But when there are some of those kind of chunks, what it suggests is having at least 6 people in your life, that is associated with some benefit. But then having more than that has been shown to have even more of a benefit. So what it suggests is that at least there is some evidence to suggest that there may be a dose response effect, and meaning for every increase, there is a decrease in risk. And there are fewer studies that show any kind of threshold or cutoff, but among those, that seems to be somewhat of a tipping point. I'm very hesitant on that, because I don't want people to just think, okay, I got 6, I'm good, I don't need to work on my relationships anymore. But I think there is that tendency that we want, it's kind of like those 10,000 steps. We want something to just be able to check off that, okay, I've got my health benefit. Unfortunately, relationships are a bit more complex than that.
Absolutely. And I think when we look at it, often we think about positive relationships that are very supportive, or negative relationships that we know are aversive. They are negative to us. They're affecting us in a negative way. But from your articles, I was really fascinated by ambivalent relationships and how this actually affects us, because I think ambivalent relationships is more common to us than we might believe. And they actually seem to have quite a large effect.
Yeah. So for any listeners that may not be familiar with ambivalent relationships, because, it's interesting, because when I talk to people, a lot of people have never heard the term. But then as soon as I describe it, they're like, oh, yeah, I've got relationships like that. And so ambivalent relationships are the types of relationships that are both positive and negative. And it's interesting because I think we think of positivity and negativity as two ends of a spectrum, but we can absolutely have mixed feelings towards others in our life. So whether it's, you know, a family member, a friend, a coworker, a neighbor. So let me give you some examples. I mean, this could be someone that you have a long history with, that you love dearly, but can also really just drive you crazy. It can be a friend that's really fun to be with, but can also be really competitive, or someone that is really helpful when you're under stress, but maybe not there for you in under other circumstances, or is really, you know, an incredible friend by all other respects, but can be really unreliable. So someone that you have this mix of positive and negative feelings towards. And like I said, a lot of people have relationships that might fit this categorization. Some people use more of a slang term, I guess, a frenemy. You know, the idea that you have a friend that can also maybe be insensitive or unreliable at times. But what this line of research really tried to ask the question of, do we benefit from the positive aspects of these relationships, or is the negative aspects of these relationships detrimental? Because as I mentioned earlier, generally speaking, we have evidence that positive supportive relationships are good for us, and negative or aversive relationships are bad for us. So what about these relationships that are a mix of both? And what some of our emerging research, and I'll just give you the summary of what we found, but with the caveat that that this research is newer, and so we just don't have as much research as we do on some of these other aspects of relationships. But what this suggests is that these relationships are actually associated with more detrimental kinds of effects. So it's been linked to greater reactivity to stress. It has been linked to greater inflammatory responses. It's been linked to cellular aging. So some of these biological processes that would suggest that if sustained over time could have negative health impacts. I guess you're probably going to ask, well, why? And so we have a few hypotheses, and at least one of our studies showed even worse outcomes. So higher blood pressure when interacting with people that you felt ambivalent towards compared to people you feel even aversive towards. And so, you know, it's obviously not surprising that it would be worse outcomes than someone who is supportive, but how does it differ from someone you feel completely aversive towards? And what we hypothesize is that someone that you feel completely aversive towards, you may be able to better cope with. You may know what to expect, and can perhaps avoid that person, or when interacting with them, may be able to better discount those negative reactions. Whereas when you have someone who is a mix of these positive and negative aspects, they may be more unpredictable, and so you have to be, you know, much more vigilant when interacting with them. But it also might be that because, as a definition, you actually care about these relationships on some level, that when there is negativity, it probably hurts a lot more because you care about that person. And there's also evidence to suggest that we maintain these relationships much closer. And so, you know, these are some potential reasons why these types of relationships may potentially have detrimental effects.
I would imagine that expectation and disappointment could be a part in that, because if you do have a lot of positive sides and interactions with this person, you might hope for or expect that things are going to change over time, that it's going to become better, or that they're going to provide you with the support that you want or need. And then if that does not happen, it creates a lot of negative emotions and a lot of disappointment. And also another aspect would then be the uncertainty, as you alluded to, that you feel that there is no control of the situation. You don't know what to expect. You're hoping for something that is going to be positive, but it might be something negative. And you feel a bit on edge all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think we can all relate to what that type of relationship feels like. I think most people probably have, or at least have had, some person like that in their life at some point.
Yeah, in our research, certainly there are some participants that have more in their networks than others, but it was very rare to find someone who didn't have any. You know, in many cases, roughly half of people's networks included those who would be characterized as ambivalent. And so it's not an uncommon feature. And our evidence suggests that these relationships are maintained long term. And so even in younger samples, some of our data suggested that they had maintained and known this person on average for 6 years. So these weren't, you know, brand new relationships that may be just very transient. These are relationships that had been in their lives for some time.
Do we know anything about negative or ambivalent relationships versus social isolation?
I once had a journalist ask me, so are you better off having an ambivalent friends or no friends at all? you know, both are not necessarily associated with good outcomes. And, you know, the hope is that you have other relationships that you can draw on to meet the variety of needs that we have in our lives. And so hopefully that would be the case. You know, it's really tough to test that empirically. And so I certainly don't have a good answer for that. And we haven't directly tested that. But yes, it is, I guess, conceptually, that I've also thought about, are there perhaps resources that we have access to because of our ambivalent relationships that might make them more advantageous than having no relationships. You know, despite some of the strain that comes along with them. But of course, we haven't adequately tested that, and that's just speculation.
Do we know how it might be related to self-esteem? Do we know if people who truly love and accept themselves have less of a tendency to enter into or maintain ambivalent relationships?
You know, that's a great question. I know we have included measures of self-esteem in a few of our samples. I don't know if we directly tested that, though. But I think it's an important hypothesis. And in fact, something that was brought up actually by a reviewer for one of my papers that really stuck with me. You know, it's interesting because academics often think of reviewers as the people who are, you know, criticizing their work. But I often learn a lot. And one of the reviewers asked a question that, you know, we certainly couldn't adequately address with the data that we had available, but has really gotten me thinking about how, you know, we design the next studies, right? And it really is along the lines of your question. And in essence, it was, to what extent does this really reflect an individual's, you know, either self-esteem or level of maturity to tolerate imperfections in others? And that, in essence, none of us are entirely positive. We all have our failings. We all are imperfect. And to what extent is it really reflect an individual's basically intolerance for the imperfections in others, and that perhaps maturity or higher self-esteem may be able to better accept or contextualize some of these failings on the part of others in their lives. And so again, it's something that we haven't adequately tested, but certainly something that I think is worth pursuing.
I feel like we often create in our interactions with other people, a lot of what we're feeling towards them is something that comes from our own perceptions. And our own perceptions are very much shaped by how we feel about ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, so along those lines, not only self-esteem, but we did look at other personality factors to see if things like extroversion and introversion had anything to do with it, and neuroticism. And interestingly, we didn't really find strong evidence of any of these personality factors influencing the extent to which people had ambivalent relationships in their network. But we also have to acknowledge that there's a lot to learn, not only about how those individual characteristics, like you mentioned with self-esteem. So how does my own individual characteristics influence the extent to how I view my relationships? But also recognizing it's an interpersonal process, and that the other person behaviorally brings something to the relationship as well. And so we need to understand this from an interpersonal perspective as well as from the individual as well.
I've had discussions before on this podcast around interactions and social connections with others and how they can be affected if you develop your own mind through, for example, loving kindness meditation, where you learn to create positive feelings towards both yourself and towards other people, and that this can actually aid in social interactions, as well as focused attention that can make you become a better listener, and that way be more supportive to others, which in turn usually results in getting more social support yourself.
So this is something that we would like to pursue, because it's really important for us to understand how can we potentially not only reduce any kind of health risk, but also how to repair and improve relationships. You know, and I'm glad you brought that up, because often the response I have instead is, so should we just ditch these relationships? and you know, we don't necessarily have evidence that people do, because the evidence actually suggests that they maintain them rather than discontinue the relationship. And so we really do need to understand how to improve these relationships, how to potentially reduce that health burden. And loving kindness meditation is one such way in which that could be pursued. And we haven't adequately pursued it yet. As I mentioned, this line of research is still relatively young, but that is an important direction, next step for sure.
Yeah. And I would imagine also meta-awareness or metacognitive awareness to become more aware of your own beliefs, your own mental structures in a way, the what triggers you and why, because this is really important. A lot of the times we get kind of a gut feeling around other people, or we get so mad with people when they do a certain thing. And then we talk to someone else about it and they go like, I don't understand why that upsets you. It doesn't upset me when people do that. And it has something to do with internal subconscious processes. And when we start to understand those, we understand also better how to interact with other people and how not to be so triggered by them.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Is there a way for people to sort of analyze their own relationships? If I would like to take a look now at, okay, so what is the degree of my social connections? What would be a good way to do that?
Well, I mean, of course, there are several well-validated surveys that exist and are publicly available online. So I'll just mention the names of a few of them. So for instance, when it comes to more of that structural aspect of social connections, the Social Network Index is one that's widely used. When it comes to the functional aspects of relationships, there are several social support measures. There's the Duke Social Support Index. There's the Sheldon Cohen has the ISEL. I think it's Interpersonal Support Evaluation List. That is also been widely used. If you're interested in assessing your level of loneliness, the UCLA Loneliness Scale is one that's widely used. And then, you know, when it comes to relationship satisfaction and ambivalence, the Social Relationships Index, that one, I'm not sure how easily it is to find online, but I think you should be able to find that. But in terms of couples relationships, there's the dyadic adjustment scale that's widely used in research. So there are many types of assessment tools, you know, but just generally speaking, you can think about each of these components and think about the size of your social network, how frequently you interact with other people. Do you belong to social groups? Each of these have been linked to health outcomes. When it comes to the functional, do you have people you can count on? If you're in a bind, whether it's for a favor or advice or just someone to listen, do you have someone you can count on and go to? And then when it comes to quality, you can think about how satisfied you are with your relationships. How helpful are they? How upsetting are they? You know, so asking yourself these kinds of questions can also give you a sense of where you're at.
Could it be valuable as well to think about what I contribute in the relationship? So let's say that I have a friend, instead of thinking, how do I feel about this person? What do they do for me? To think about, okay, well, how am I a good friend to this person? What am I contributing? Am I actually listening? Am I really supportive? And use that as a way to evaluate the relationship as well.
So that's really a great point, because there's research to suggest that actually providing support has been associated with better health effects than even receiving support. And so if you feel like you need a friend, be a friend. how can you be a better friend? How can you reach out to people who might need someone in their life or need help? This has consistently been associated with better kinds of outcomes, including reduced loneliness.
Because I think it's easy to get stuck a little bit in the mindset of thinking, well, what types of people do I have around me? How do I find more people to support me? And maybe feel a little bit like it's difficult to find friends. It's difficult to just all of a sudden have perfect relationships with your family or with your spouse. And to then move the focus away from yourself and outwards might actually help and see, okay, but what am I contributing in all of these relationships? And what could I do to make this relationship a better one for the other person? And then that often has some form of added effect of improving life for yourself as well.
Yeah. So research suggests that, you know, of course, these interpersonal processes unfold over time. that influence the extent to which we perceive relationship satisfaction. You know, at a very basic level, if you think about it, how you behave can in turn influence the kind of response you get in return. And oftentimes people behave in ways that is reinforcing, meaning you kind of get what you give in the sense of, you know, if I'm extremely friendly and complimentary to you, I'm much more likely to get a positive response in return than a negative one. Whereas if I very standoffish or closed off or in some way responding in a negative way, I'm less likely to get a positive response and friendly response in return. And so it's helpful to start thinking about how we behave. In fact, in the loneliness research, one of the factors that has been identified is a negative cognitive bias, this tendency to perceive ambiguous social information in a negative way. So I like to give the example of, because I think we've all been there where you text at someone, you know, a friend, and they don't respond right away. So it's ambiguous, but you might automatically assume that they are ignoring you or they're ghosting you, you know, and so you could go to that negative. Well, if you respond in a negative way, like, why aren't you responding? You know, you're going to get some defensiveness in return. Whereas if, you know, instead you think, well, maybe that person was in a meeting, maybe they were driving, you know, there could be a number of reasons why that person didn't respond right away. And so if we respond in negative ways to ambiguous situations, that negative response can reinforce and it becomes a cycle. And so, you know, I really love what you brought up earlier, because if you can think about what you as an individual bring to a relationship, how can you instead turn that into something where it's going to, you get the kinds of responses that you actually want from your friends. And so often that takes some introspection to really think about that, but it also requires some perspective taking and empathy and, you know, a variety of skills to really then begin to change some of these patterns that ultimately can influence and strengthen relationships and social bonding over time.
And I think the good news there is that these are learnable skills. These are things that you can develop. You can develop your mind, you can develop your mindsets, and you can work on these particular skills in order to improve life for yourself and also for other people around you. So what are you working on now? Is there anything in the future coming up that you're really excited about?
Oh gosh, yes. There are a number of studies that I've collected some data on, some of which were done over the pandemic in trying to understand how this has impacted individuals, and some international kinds of studies. But some of the work that I'm doing is also really translating the evidence into practice. And so in the U.S., I am working with the Administration for Community Living, which is housed under Health and Human Services. And I'm part of a committee that is helping to evaluate and establish a national clearinghouse of interventions. And so it's meant to be a resource, a nationally available resource of evidence-based interventions, so that people who may be at risk can look to this centralized resource, and as well as community-based organizations who may be looking for potential solutions, or either to replicate or to refer their clientele or users to, but that we have a way of rating them based on the level of evidence, whether it's promising, you know, all the way to well-established and well-documented. And And of course, it's going to run the gamut, but helping to really provide that as a resource to help people. Also working with various organizations to help establish measurement approaches. And in particular, I'm working with the Gravity Project to help to have a way of assessing this in the electronic health record. So taking this and having a way for in the medical setting for patients to be assessed so that they can have, so that individuals can be identified early on and we can begin to mitigate some of this risk early on rather than waiting until it's much later. So really trying to find ways to work with organizations to make real world differences. How do we implement this evidence in a way that can help population health? And so those are some, just a few of the things that I'm working on right now.
That is amazing. And so thank you so much for the very important work that you're doing and for what you are contributing to the world. And thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
It's time to go through some major points from today's talk. Social connections can be described as and divided into three major components. The first is the structure of the connections, meaning the size of your social network and the frequency of your social contacts. The second component is the function of these connections, meaning how you relate to these people and the amount of social support you feel you receive. And then the third and final component is the quality of these connections, meaning the extent to which there are positive or negative aspects in them and how they impact your well-being. Extensive research spanning over decades now show that a higher level of social connection, as composed of these three components, is associated with health protection, and low level of social connection is associated with risk. Some of the strongest evidence is associated with risk for premature death, meaning you have a higher chance of survival when socially connected. It also influences our overall health, with the strongest evidence linked to cardiovascular morbidity, meaning heart disease as well as stroke. There are also known benefits for mental health and cognitive health. The reason for this effect is believed to come from a heightened stress response when disconnected socially, and all the different aspects of our physiology that are affected by that in the long term. As would be expected, positive relationships are most beneficial for us, while negative relationships, meaning the ones that lead to frustration, anxiety, or other forms of psychological stress, have a negative impact on our health. There is also something called ambivalent connections, and this describes a relationship with both positive and negative effects simultaneously. A colloquial term for this is a frenemy, the type of relationship where you are invested in maintaining it due to its positive sides, but at the same time, there are sides to it that are negative. This mix of positive and negative feelings may possibly be worse for your health than fully negative connections. This might be because the positive sides makes us stay closer to the person, but at the same time, we feel stressed or anxious, since there is always a risk of the interaction to be negative. So what can we do to better understand how our own social connections affect us? Well, the first step is to reflect over our own social network. There are several validated surveys online that are used in research and that you can use to test yourself if you're interested. But more importantly, you can reflect over some questions. What is the size of your network? How frequently do you interact with others? Do you belong to social groups? If you encounter a problem, do you have someone you can turn to for support? How satisfied are you with your relationships? How helpful or upsetting are they to you? So, how can you develop your social connections and improve the structure, function, and quality of them? When it comes to the structure, you can either look to reconnect with friends you made in the past but lost contact with along the way, or you can nurture connections you already have, but maybe don't interact with very frequently. And then you can, of course, make new connections. To improve the function or quality of the relationship, the easiest and most important part is to look to your own contribution. Ask yourself how caring you are for this person and how good of a listener you might be. There are ways to improve those qualities in yourself through something called loving kindness meditation or focus meditation, where you develop skills that are important when connecting with others. Providing support to others has shown to have better health effects than receiving support and is something you have control over. As the saying goes, if you need a friend, be a friend. If you have a negative or ambivalent relationship, you might not want to just discontinue it, but instead work on repairing or improving it to achieve a positive connection instead. If this does not work, however, it's probably beneficial for your health to focus more on other connections with a more positive impact. For me, this episode was full of interesting input on how we can improve our physical health at the same time as our psychological well-being, and now we know better than to overlook this important aspect of our life and happiness. Thank you for joining me today, and if you like this episode and would like to learn more about the brain, health, and happiness, I would love to see you next time, so please subscribe to the show.